So we're looking at the four facts for the noble ones. See, this is where we can see, we take the words happiness and suffering kind of for granted, you know, like, yeah, wow. But really Buddha's saying this is what drives all beings in the universe, this fundamental wish for happiness and not for suffering. And this very much becomes the basis of our developing love and compassion for others, because love is the wish, may you be happy. Compassion is the wish, may you not suffer. It's based on that. And what we tried to do, we discussed last night, equanimity, and we'll go back to that later, the bodhisattva aspect. It's recognizing that's what every being in the universe wants. And we use that as our basis for then developing this profound, you know, may you be happy, may you not suffer. And then the powerful bodhisattva attitude of I will make it happen. So happiness and suffering don't take lightly. It's the way Buddha's view of way of defining the entire universe in terms of happiness and suffering and its causes. He's practical, you know. We're so used to thinking religion just is cross your fingers and hope for the best and believe something. That's superstition for the Buddha. Okay. So suffering, first kind, the one we all accept when the bad things happen. Causes, past karma, delusion. Karma and the mind. And they subsume to one. The mind, what's in here, determines what we do and think and say, therefore determines how we program ourselves, which is the simplest meaning of karma, you know. I mean, we sort of understand it. When it comes to intellectual pursuits and creative pursuits, we sort of understand that everything we think and do and say is what precisely will produce the musician. But when it comes to morality, we kind of lose the plot. We're so superstitious. Oh, I can think what I like. And we wonder why we turn into neurotic people, because we've programmed ourselves into a neurotic person. But we don't see that what goes on in here plays a role, whereas we know what goes on in here plays a role when you become a pianist. We know it's crucial to get the right notes from Bach. You can't just say, I can play what I like. You can, but it won't be Bach. But when it comes to morality, we're kind of weird, lost, just constrained and confused and emotional. So causes of suffering, central player is action and then what's in the mind that drives it. So first kind of suffering is when the bad things happen. So a cause of that imply, if we take this, okay, if we take this packaging and, you know, as we know, the Tibetans call it the lamrim, gradual path. It's a way of presenting that all of Buddha's teachings and practices in an orderly way, like I said. So like I said, we can divide it into junior school, high school, university, if you like, even postgraduate. Junior school and high school is the wisdom wing. That's the Theravadan part of the path, which we all share. Junior school, control your body and speech. High school, get into your mind. University, bodhisattva path. Postgraduate, that's in the Tibetan tradition, that's the Vajrayana. It's a way of saying it. It helps us get our head around it. So junior school practice, which is abiding by the laws of karma, being an ethical person, back off and don't kill, don't lie, don't steal, etc., etc., etc. Why? This is a crucial point. Why is Buddha exhorting us to do that? We've got to ask the question, why? Well, as we said, you know, it's a very powerful point, as we discussed in the week. The reason as a Christian, I remember I asked my Jesuit priest friend, the logical reason as a Christian to not kill and steal, etc., and this is a really crucial point, is because God said. This is powerful. If he is the boss, if there is a being who is the boss who runs the show, then it's absolutely correct. You've got to obey his orders. And he has the power to punish and reward. And that's our view of morality, isn't it? At a very simple level. Not the Buddha's. He tells us to not kill, lie, steal. Well, he exhorts us to. He recommends it. But he's like a doctor. It's a good example. Doctor says don't smoke. Why not? You get cancer, honey. We don't say, how dare you say you'll punish me with cancer. We don't say that. We thank her for her kindness in warning us. So we know she's not the boss. She's not telling us to not, you know, smoke cigarettes because she said so. That's weird. Because she's observed the consequences to me if I smoke cigarettes. So how kind she is telling me there could be dire results. We're grateful. But if we hear Buddha say that by being a naughty person you're going to cause yourself suffering, we get all upset. Like he's punishing us. He's not a punisher. He's not a rewarder. He's just warning us. This is what we do to ourselves. We're the boss. We're the creator. It's a very powerful point. So in junior school, this is the solution to the first kind of suffering. So karmically speaking, very simply, why do I get killed, lied to, stolen from? Because I've done actions like that. This is not sort of cosmic or religious. This is Buddha's analysis. Because everything we think and do and say leaves seeds in our mind, programs our mind to produce future. You know, everything we think and do and say produces our future. We produce ourselves. Like everything you think and do and say with music produces the future musician. We don't think that's cosmic. Well, why do we think morality is cosmic? It's very silly. Same thing. Just programming. So the first kind of suffering, when the bad things happen, is the solution is stop causing it, which is, guess what? Don't kill. If you don't want to be killed and don't want to get sick. Okay, remember, there are four results of karma. Four ways karma ripens. Type of rebirth. Our tendencies in that rebirth. The experiences you get at the hands of others, and this is a major way we suffer, or have happiness, and even environmental result, four ways. So we can see in this life what we call suffering. Sickness is one. But the other major sickness is when bad things happen from other people. We know the pain of our lives is that one. That's called experiences similar to the cause. And remember, if karma is a natural law, no one runs it. It's a natural law like botany or gravity. You don't have to know it even for it to happen. It just happens because it's a law. So you can learn it and control it, absolutely. That's what ethics is for Buddha. So the Buddha would say don't kill, but his reason is not because he says so. It's because he says, guess what, Rabina? That'll produce your future suffering. So I don't want suffering, or don't create it. Stop killing, stop lying, stop stealing, live an ethical life. That's the answer. That's the solution to the first level of suffering. Abide by the laws of karma, junior school. Now the next level of suffering is the more subtle one, the more nuanced one, the suffering of change, which is driven by attachment and all the dramas of all the delusions. So the solution to that, go to high school and start working on your mind, get to the root of the problem, start to unpack and unravel the nonsense, get some shamatha, get some concentration, so you can then start to reprogram your mind. How amazing. And you stop the second kind of suffering by giving up attachment. Wow. Third kind, all pervasive. We've all got that one. And that's the most primordial. And that is sort of like, it's as if, somebody, if we take even attachment as the main cause of the problem in this desire realm, then, like we said, you know, the first kind is when attachment doesn't get what it wants, which is the bad things. The second kind of suffering is when attachment does get what it wants. But the third kind of suffering, all pervasive suffering, is like you're born in the first place in a body of the five senses, driven by attachment, which is the junkie in us, and the junkie has to get the objects of the attachment, which is the heroine, and the heroine is the world we occupy, the five sense objects. So there we are, born in a body of a junkie, driven by you know, the junkie mind that has to survive, has to ingest the heroine, which is the five sense objects. So that's all pervasive suffering, like no choice. You're locked into it. So the solution to the first kind of suffering, stop harming others, junior school. The solution to the second kind of suffering, get into your mind and unpack and unravel and get rid of all the rubbish and the attachment and the nonsense. Stop the second kind of suffering. Stop the third kind of suffering, cut the root, realize emptiness. Then you're out of here. Then you're out of samsara. You're done. You're cooked. You're finished. But you can go on to the bodhisattva path and help others now. Because now you see we're all in the same boat. How could you possibly not help? Because as you get less neurotic and more fulfilled and more blissful, you also get more compassionate. So you couldn't possibly want to leave others behind. That's the bodhisattva path. So, cessation is really Buddha's, and goes in great detail, his presentation of how there is this possibility to stop suffering and its causes, which finally is all the path we've just laid out. Which is really one way of presenting the fourth step, the methods. So it's a way of presenting. You know, they've got the eight nice ways to live. What's that called? Eightfold path. That's that one way of presenting the path, which is the fourth. This way of the Lam Rim presenting is another way of presenting the solution, you know. Controlling your body speech, controlling your mind, and then realizing emptiness. Another way of presenting the fourth step, the fourth of the four truths, you know, the method of how to stop suffering and its causes. So it's a practical presentation, you know. That's the Four Noble Truths. Now, the next lot, it says, there is no exalted wisdom. Okay, we've got to get into the no business now. What's this no business? It gets very depressing. Know this and know that. And we think, well, why bother? Like we said yesterday, you know, it's really, I mean, Tsongkhapa, our lineage lama, 14th century lineage lama of our tradition in Tibetan Buddhism, as you know, there are many traditions, and they all come to the same thing, but each of them, like in, sure, in Japan, there's many styles of Zen, isn't there? Many masters over the centuries, and they all suit our minds, different minds in different ways, which is totally appropriate, you know. I mean, look at the Christians, must be hundreds of variations. So Tsongkhapa really stresses the way to understand ultimate reality is in the framework of conventional reality. These two truths kind of ground us and prevent us from falling off into the abyss of the great mistake and becoming nihilistic. And the other extreme is the eternalistic one. So you could say, you could argue what that, in the world, what that's referring to is the philosophical views that posit a soul, an intrinsic, permanent soul or spirit, or the Greeks call it an essence. That is a way of presenting, roughly speaking, the philosophy of eternalism, which for the Buddha is one of the mistakes. The other mistake is nihilism. And he says that one's the worst. Better to have faith in God. Better to have faith in the Creator. Better, at least that causes you to be virtuous. The nihilistic one is like a nightmare, you know. That's the danger. Can't fall into the abyss of the great mistake. And the commonest way to misunderstand emptiness is to think of it as nihilism. So it's really kind of subtle, the meaning. And this is where we need to have, I mean, it would seem, have valid teachers, valid teachings, not just believe anything anyone tells you. And because in the West we think, you know, you go to a course and you get some kind of vision, you write a book. Excuse me. You know? It takes a while to become a knowledge holder, even of cooking. So trust our sources, you know? Have valid masters, valid teachers, valid lamas, valid gurus. It's important to check. Because in Buddhism itself, there are variations of the, and they all even debate among themselves, which is healthy. But there are different styles for different minds. You know, we find the style that works for our mind, the style, you know. That's important. So Tsongkhapa says it's so important to understand the two truths in order to understand ultimate reality, emptiness, no self. So let's look at it again in that framework. And then we'll go through the rest of the list, but why there's know this and know that. Okay, so just putting the words on it from the ultimate point of view, from the final point of view, everything that exists, whatever is said to exist, and that's interesting, that gets to the conventional. This is what we discuss, remember, that before we even discuss how things exist, we have to conventionally establish what exists conventionally. You can't just, you know, if you have to, this is a really important point. If you want to discuss colour, you can talk about red. You can talk about red existing. And you know red exists because you've had experiences of red. We can go on about how red is this and red is that and red is true. Red exists. That's not wrong. But what if you have to have a direct experience of red? You've got to ground it into having thing in front of you that possesses the characteristic of red. Then red is an experience. Think about that. The general idea of red, but then there's the specific. You have to have a cup or something that possesses the characteristic of red colour. So that's like conventional reality. So here, the thing we're discussing is the emptiness of inherent existence. That's the thing, which not red, but the emptiness of inherent existence. And of course, that's more subtle and more abstract than red. We can get red because we've seen it and understand it. But here, there's a characteristic that Buddha says everything that exists possesses. So right there, that very statement tells us it's not just emptiness, like, wow, emptiness, you know, nothingness, empty, there's nothingness. That's an abstract. That's like saying there's red. But if emptiness of inherent existence is true, to have an experience of emptiness of inherent existence, you have to have a thing that possesses the emptiness of inherent existence. That's the conventional reality. So before we even start discussing the ultimate way that things exist, we have to establish a thing. So Buddha says, whatever exists, all the phenomena of the universe, a cup, a toilet, a microphone, a person, a Buddha, a hell being, a mind, a moment of anger, an atom. We have to first establish it, label it, define it, so we can all be on the same page. We can all agree in a conventional language what a cup is. It's very logical. Then we now need, we can posit it, but we then now can discuss how that cup exists, both conventionally and therefore ultimately, because they come to the same thing. They're the flip sides of the coin. But the words we have to use and the concepts, we want to discuss it philosophically. When we meditate and when we have the experience of it, it's beyond concepts, that's clear. That's the Mahamudra approach. But there's also perfectly valid to talk about it. We need to get our heads around it. We have concepts. Our mind is full of concepts right now. That's where we live. So we can use those concepts. Sometimes we can misuse them, definitely. But we can use them validly to help us taste that leads us to the experience. Okay, people have different kinds of minds, you know. There's a friend of mine who's a Buddhist, and she's got incredible wisdom and helps people. She's a therapist, and she helps many people. And she has, it seems to me, extraordinary wisdom, knowing her for many years. And then I like all this stuff, talking, blah, blah, you know, this four, this five, that six, and I like that. So we start talking, and she goes blank. My mind doesn't work that way, she said. And I get it. I understand. But in the end, we can say we need both aspects, but in the end, it's all got to lead to experience. If it doesn't lead to experience, that's like, as Lama says, confusing a pizza box for a pizza. You'll be in trouble. Or confusing a recipe for a cake. Oh, I'm a brilliant cook. I know all the recipes. Make me a cake. Oh, I can't do that. Then you're not a cook, baby. It's just intellectual rubbish. So intellectual, don't throw the baby out of the bathwater, though, and think, therefore, intellectual is nonsense. That's too extreme. It leads to experience. If it doesn't, you're in trouble. Okay. So let's, as we discussed, we do this in the week. We'll look again at the particular phenomenon called person. So there are various synonyms. Person, I, me, self. They're synonyms. They all refer to the phenomenon called a person. We're one of them. We're not an iPad. We're not a microphone. We're not a cup. We define it. You know, what is a cup? Container that holds your tea. You prove it, you agree, you know, you prove it. You can't just believe somebody. You've got to prove it holds your tea. So you pour the tea and you can all see it hold. So then it functions. It functions to hold your tea. And then we tick the box. That's a conventional phenomenon called a cup. Now we have to discuss its reality. Because we've got it wrong, Buddha says. We know to the extent that we can call it a cup, we've got that right. But what we don't see, he says, is we've got these layers, as Lama Zopa puts it, in our mind, we have these layers and layers and layers of misconceptions that are primordially deep. There are all the emotional ones called attachment and anger and all that, as well as the intellectual ones like, no, can't, mummy made you, your mind, your brain, there is a God and all those things. Buddha's arguing with those conceptions. He's not being rude. He says they're not valid, they're not true. He's from experience, he's proven they're not. That's up to you, though, to look into it. So all these misconceptions, and what misconceptions do, what they function to do, because they're so automatic, is they inform everything we see and taste and touch and smell and feel, and they're deeply primordially habitual. So when you've got your rose-coloured spectacles on, you say that in Italian? Your rose-coloured spectacles, you say that in Italian? Your rose-coloured spectacles. You don't have that saying? What is it? Tell it.
Mettere gli occhiali rosa, mettere le lenti rosa.
That one. Your rose-coloured, it's a really great analogy. You've got your rose-coloured spectacles on, everything looks lovely, doesn't it? That's attachment. That's attachment. The fisherman had his rose-coloured spectacles on and just saw the beauty of the sea and the nature and all these lovely fish and the hooks and he couldn't see the suffering. He was blind as a bat. So all these misconceptions, as Lama Zopa says, and because they're so habitual, they decorate our mind. In other words, these concepts decorate on top of what is there, layers upon layers upon layers of characteristics that just aren't there. Because it's so automatic, we just can't see it. Now, we know it's true. I mean, you know, if Lamo, the Venerable Lamo here, sees that cup, she says, oh, God, that's an ugly cup. And I go, oh, that's a pretty cup. It's really obvious that each of us has a certain concept in our mind that decorates on top of this cup. Each of us, I exaggerate its nice qualities and she exaggerates its ugly qualities. So it's really obvious what we're doing, what Buddha says, but we don't kind of get the message from it. We don't get the teaching from it. That should prove emptiness immediately. There's no intrinsic cup. It's right there staring at us. But we don't get it. She just believes her view and I believe my view. She doesn't think, and even this is so powerful, she doesn't even think she's got a view about the cup. She thinks what she sees is the cup. That's the killer. So I think what I see is the cup too. It is a pretty cup, in its bones, in the cupness itself. That's how this delusions function. They lie, but we don't see it. This is really extraordinary, actually. So we first established that there is a cup that does, that's a flat bottom container that holds your tea. So we have to look at, first, in order, this is what's interesting, this approach here uses the conventional reality of the cup, that is to say, it is a dependent arising, it arises, it exists, in dependence upon many factors. We look into that and unpack that and analyze that and deconstruct that. And that's the logic we use that then proves the ultimate truth, that therefore there is no cup from its own side. There's different ways we talk, like Mahamudra, a particular approach, Dzogchen, maybe I've heard about Zen meditation too. You bypass the concepts. You go to the taste. And in a way you could say that really is, it is more sophisticated. It's like going straight to the piano and trying to play Bach without learning the theory. You think about that, that's pretty scary, isn't it? This is the same here, you know? That's very direct. But ironically, you can sort of... I remember one lama in Italy. Yeah, Italy. We're here, aren't we, Italy? Yeah, I remember. I hear these stories and I'm Italy there. Okay, this one, I can't think of who he was. What's his name? Namkhai Norbu, Dzogchen practitioner. He said for years and years and years and years he was training all his students in Dzogchen. Then he gave up and he said, I've got to go back to the basics again. Started talking about refuge, karma, impermanence, all the nuts and bolts that we think is so boring. Oh, I want to do Dzogchen, please, you know. So we've got to know where we're at, you know. We can easily mislead ourselves. So conventional reality is the shorthand is dependent arising. Dependent arising. Dependent arising. Things exist or arise. There's many synonyms for dependent arising, too. Things exist. Come into being. Exist. In dependence upon. So there's many, as we discussed before, there are many ways in which things exist dependently. But we can present three different levels that is coming Buddha's particular arguments with three prevailing views. Speaking simply, there's many variations of the views in Indians before the Buddha, the same as the Buddhist views. We can speak kind of keep it really simple, and we can conflate these a little bit, but it's kind of levels of dependent arising. The first one is that things exist independent upon causes, and that's pretty powerful. And that you won't find any cup here, other than the causes. Because cup is nothing other than the coming together of causes. That's the first one. Not even technically proving emptiness, just kind of proving kind of like subtle impermanence or something. Cause and effect. Then the one we discussed, the tasty one, we can get into a little bit, which is not the subtlest, is parts. Things exist in dependence upon their parts, their bits and pieces. This is a massive thing in Buddhism. Huge, when you study the philosophy, a huge amount of work looking into what things are made of. How the Buddha's point here is everything that exists. A moment of mind, a microphone, a realm, a Buddha, a hell being, a dog, a toe, everything that we can posit as being a phenomenon and existent necessarily exists in dependence upon its bits and pieces. So even the millionth of a second is a phenomenon that has parts. Itself is made of parts. In other words, you can't ever get to a partless particle. There's a whole tradition, a whole teaching in the Indian tradition that asserts such a phenomenon. And all the West, the scientists, it seems to me, all this pursuit for the subtlest kind of atom, exploding. What is all that? Those people have those tunnels and they're exploding all the things to try and find the partless particles. Thank you, all that business. Yeah. Okay, that one. Whatever it is, I don't know. But Buddha says you can't possibly, and there's masses of discussions and debates on this, you've got to really think about it. You will never come to a particle that doesn't have parts. You can't, logically, he says. This is already kind of, because we instinctively want to find, want to set in stone, find something. There it is, in isolation, in itself, of itself. There it is, now we've got it. That's the primordial instinct of this misconception in our bones, this ego grasping, you know. Buddha says can't exist, not possible. Then even in the different Buddhist traditions, certainly the way that's presented when we study Buddhist tenets, coming from India, the views in India, you know, the four different kinds, many, many sub-schools of variations of presentations of, in particular, emptiness. So many. So the Theravadan one, I think, is the only remaining sub-school of the 18 sub-schools of the Satrantika views or something like that. Or is it Vaibhashika? I don't remember. Many, many, over the centuries, the thinkers. And that's nothing wrong with that. It's good. They all debate with each other. Nothing wrong. So the subtlest one, as we know, presented by the Prasangika view, the consequentialist middle way view, the middle way. And there's variations of the middle way view, but the one we taught from our lamas, are taught by our teachers, the Prasangika, the consequentialist one, very specific view, that says the subtlest meaning of dependent arising is that the first one is impermanent phenomena depend. There's nothing that doesn't depend upon causes. And then the second one is that all phenomena, there's nothing that doesn't depend upon its parts. The third one, there's nothing that doesn't exist. There's nothing that exists that doesn't depend upon the mind calling it that. In a sense, it's not too difficult to prove when it comes to, you know, phenomena. We can go into it. But it seems to me, even though it's meant to be easier to realize the emptiness of this self, it seems much harder to get hold of that idea when it comes to ourself. But let's look at other phenomena. It seems fairly clear. So first of all, let's say we establish a thing called a prison. We can establish it conventionally. And the conventional way, to define a prison, usually, certainly in America, I mean, sometimes they're nice, is an ugly building where you're sent when you're naughty or meant to be naughty and you can't escape from it. Maybe that's a good definition of a prison, okay? So you've got to establish that and agree upon it. What's a prison, Mummy? You can't just say, oh, it's a toilet, dear. No, you've got to agree. Come on, get on the earth. So now you know what a prison is. And that's a conventional reality. But this is the point. We can say that. We can say what a cup is. We can say what an iPad is. And we must. But what we don't realize, as soon as we say it, we're over-exaggerating it. We're embellishing it. We're setting it in stone. We're putting all these decorations on top. But we've still got to start somewhere. So a prison is that. Now, this is the thing. This ego grasp, this ignorance, this root delusion, instantaneously what it does, as soon as we see the prison, we have our concrete, profoundly deep, instinctive, set-in-stone, absolute from its own side glasses on that causes the prison to appear intrinsically, inherently, in itself, in the bricks, in the mortar, in the wardens, in the cells, in the wire, to be intrinsically a prison from its own side. These are the words we have to comprehend. It is a prison, but there's no prison from its own side. It is a prison. You can't say it's not, because that's nihilism if you say that. But not from its own side. These are the two seeming contradictions we have to get together in our minds. They seem like Buddha's saying, you kind of want to say, well, make up your mind, mate. Is there a prison or isn't there? Come on. But it's more nuanced than that. Got to be more subtle in our understanding. So the point is, Buddha's saying, if prison were intrinsic, and we don't think like this, so try and get used to thinking it. It means in this case especially, if we think there is a prison that exists there, and this is the point now, without depending on my mind calling it that, giving it, buying into that meaning. If there were a prison which is that doesn't depend upon my mind calling it a prison, that doesn't depend upon my mind giving it that meaning, that doesn't depend on my mind buying into that prison, then if there were a prison like that, that would be an independent prison. That would be an intrinsic prison. That would be an inherent prison. That would be a prison that doesn't depend on anything for its existence. And all Buddha's saying is nothing can exist like that, because everything's a dependent arising. So if there were that prison, Buddha says, and it's pretty easy to say it, then that, no matter who sees it, you'd know it's a prison. And who lives in there, even if they live like my Norwegian friend who wrote to me and said he's so looking forward to going to prison because it's in the country with vegetable gardens and education systems, it's like not prison at all. The only component of prison is he can't escape from it. But it's like divine, sounds great to me, it's like a retreat. But if prison were that ugly place where you're sent when you're naughty and you can't escape from, which it is conventionally, but if it were intrinsically that, you'd all know it. And you could, and because it is called an unhappy place, that's a definition of a not a very nice place. That's the point. It's under the heading of not nice, not nice. Then everybody would know it's a prison and you would always be miserable. And we know that's not true. Like right there, that example of that woman I always quote, the woman in Florida 30 years ago, 40 years ago, hitching with a hippie husband, hippie kids, nice white lady, hippie, gets picked up by two blokes. They get picked up by the police. The blokes kill the police and blame the hippies. So they're on death row. I mean, the nightmare you can't imagine, you know. Then she gives her three children over to her parents and her parents get killed in a car accident, so she loses the children into the system. A husband gets executed. Can you imagine the nightmare of this innocent fellow? But she, this amazing, she was there for 17 years and got out eventually, you know. But she said, when I read, I just touched on, I read a bit of her memoir. This is like the words she said are like proving they're the essence of all the Buddha's teachings. She said, I decided I couldn't change anything, you know, but they couldn't take my mind from me. So I decided I'm not a prisoner, I'm a monk. I'm not in a cell, I'm in a cave. I mean, we love to hear about things like this, but look at the pain we have when one person criticizes us, and 47 years ago, we still have the bitter pain and hurt. So it shows how deep we don't believe that we have the power to change our minds, which is proving that there's no intrinsic prison. If she could learn to be happy in that prison and call it a cell, she relabeled it. And the key point about this is very fascinating. They talk about conventional reality and you define it, and the key thing, the key part of a definition is the function of the thing. It sounds kind of sort of nothing, but it's very powerful. So what a cup is the thing that holds your tea. That's the key function of a cup, isn't it? It could be, you know, massive, it could be small, it could be like a thimble, but it holds your tea. That's the constant. That's the in a way, that's the meaning of the cup. In the definition, you can say it's a flat-bottom clay container, but you're not happy yet. You haven't got the meaning of it, the essence of it, the function of it. What does it do? It holds tea. What is a microphone? It amplifies sound. You've got to get the function. This is kind of crucial. Then this is the point. They say when you've realized emptiness of the prison, you've realised there's no prison from its own side. You've cut the grasping at this horrible, ugly out there from its own side prison causing me unhappiness that woman had. If you realise that, it doesn't mean you've annihilated a prison. It doesn't mean the walls disappear and turn into a rainbow. No, don't be cosmic. There's still an ugly building there with barbed wire and bricks and horrible warders who think she's horrible. That hasn't changed a fraction from the simple physical point of view. That's the so the function of prison is to lock you in and keep you, if you like, function is to lock you in and you're sent as if you're naughty and you can't escape. But that doesn't change. It's still that. You still can't, she can't walk into, it's because she's realised that prison is no longer horrible. She can't just suddenly, it doesn't disappear through the walls. It's still there, but she sees it differently. So where's the prison for her? This is the point the Buddha's making. So So seeing the emptiness of a cup doesn't mean it suddenly doesn't hold your tea anymore. There's still a cup. But as Zamazopa says, when you realize the emptiness of the cup, it's as if there's no cup. But there is a cup. But it's as if it doesn't exist. It's as if it's an illusion. These are kind of so tasty. And it's not just meant to be tricky. When we understood this, this is the truth, you know. So the two truths have to be together. You can't. So that's where nihilism would go, oh, there's no prison, so you chuck out the brick walls. No, you don't, I promise. She still had brick walls and barbed wire and warders thinking she's a creep. But she changed her view. So it appeared differently to her. That's the point. Therefore, she was happy. And she kept her sanity and she managed to get out of prison. Whereas the other guy always explained the same time. This other man I read about who on death row in prison, who, like normal people, went crazy, full of rage and despair and grief and hurt. Obviously, he was innocent. And he spent every day as long as he had a voice. I did not rape and kill that woman. I did not rape and kill that woman. Now, this is the point. They both lived in ugly prisons. They were both innocent. And look at the difference. She had this miraculous ability, you know. I think she did yoga and things. I don't think she was a Buddhist. She had this marvelous ability to change her mind. This is so intelligent. You can't believe it. It's phenomenal. Like the most amazing emotional intelligence, isn't it? She could see this nightmare. She couldn't change it. Husband executed. Children gone. Parents dead. Innocent. You can't, one horror upon the other, you know. And we can see in the world, this is what causes us to go insane because we just can't cope with the pain. So it's a miraculous thing. This woman somehow had the ability, you know, to change her mind, to see, to use his intelligence, she could do it. That's what Buddha's telling us. And we can see it's the hardest thing we'll ever do, but it's possible. And that's proving there's no intrinsic prison from its own side, because if there were, she couldn't possibly have seen it differently. But it didn't annihilate the prison. There were still the brick walls and the warders who thought she was ugly and the barbed wire. That never changed. In the simplest sense, you understand? This is where you can't have nihilism. Oh, there's no prison. What's it matter? That's nihilism. Wrong meaning. This way of putting these two, especially in relation to the mind labelling it that, which is the subtle dependent arising. When we say, oh, the mind makes it up, we just think what that means is fantasy. It's a fantasy. Oh, the mind makes it up, we say. Buddha's saying that, but not in, he doesn't mean what we're saying. We just mean it's all not true. You made it all up, it's not true. That's nihilism. It's not, Buddha's not saying it like that. Because remember, the emptiness of intrinsic existence is not just some abstract thing in the sky. It's the characteristic of something that exists conventionally. You won't find emptiness of intrinsic existence nowhere. You won't find emptiness of intrinsic existence except on a thing. This is the interesting point, you know. So you can't have you can't have nihilism. But as Ramazaba says, it's as if something exists. And even though there is still bricks and mortar there and walls and warders and horrible stuff, it's still that. But the way we see it is so profoundly different. That's the thing that Buddha's saying. We see, we give all this heavy status to the thing. We think we're this innocent victim of that horrible thing harming us. That's the way the delusions function. We dump all the power onto the external, and I'm this poor, pathetic, innocent victim who gets, you know, has good luck and bad luck, like I'm this just like a nothing person. That's the suffering of this demented, dualistic view of ego grasping, you know, Buddha says. So when we completely kind of take our power back, if you like, and realize everything comes from our mind, and that projects onto things out there. So the woman in the prison who's happy and content, and also the irony is because she's happy, she's working on her freedom. The other poor guy couldn't do anything. He was just out of his brain with rage, believing his suffering was coming from the prison. This is the point. It's hard to hear. I mean, when a person yells at you and punches in the nose, it's really hard to realize you're not suffering because of that. I mean, it's shocking. It's very shocking. It plays a role, but it's only a trigger. Everything goes on in the mind. I mean, it's true. I did kung fu. I got punched in the nose regularly. I didn't mind. I was happy. I was supposed to apologize to my sparring partner. I was told by my kung fu teacher, and that's the bodhisattvas. That's the attitude the Chinese, when they first invented the monks up in the mountains, and methods, they created martial arts, the bodhisattva monks, to deal with the crazy thieves and the burglars who'd come along. So the teacher I had, we were trained that when we were having a spar and I got punched, I would apologize to my partner because I didn't get out of the way in time. So I wasn't unhappy when I got punched. I wasn't unhappy at all. That proves being punched is not the cause of suffering. This is very shocking to hear. I'm sorry to be rude, but isn't it? You can hear it. You can hear it. You can hear it. So what's the difference? What's the difference? The way the mind sees it. It's so clear. All this is proving emptiness, meaning nothing from the side of the thing. It's still a punch. I still get punched, and I still broke my thing on my knee, and I couldn't do my kung fu, and I had crutches. That was true. But how you see it is what gives it, makes it happiness or suffering. That's the Buddha's amazing point about the power of the mind, you know. That's how we call it. We don't, you see, that's the thing. You call it a cup. It's not as if you create a cup. That's silly. There is already a basis sitting there well before I looked at it. It's not like, oh, if there's a tree in the forest, if no one sees it. That's silly. It's not like that. It's not as if I make it a cup and suddenly go, whoop, whoop, cup. No, not like that. Not like that. There's already a concrete, there's already a clay container there that's been labelled a cup a long time ago that someone bought in a shop. But for me, it's a cup. When I buy into it, it's a cup. That's what it means. You know. The building was there well before I was sent there, the prison, you know. It's sort of like we buy into the meaning. We buy into the meaning. And Buddha's empty as well. There's always a Buddha there. They did all the hard work for countless eons. You can't say they didn't. But I would never know it's a Buddha until I buy into the view that it's a Buddha. Like Lama Zopa said, the simple example. That three lines on the blackboard when you're a kid. A. If it were A from its own side, on the blackboard, in those lines, then you'd say, oh, miss, that's A. Before you were told, no, we know it's not like that. She's got to tell you it's A. And this is how Lama Zopa said it works, because of the grasping. You see the lines, and you go, oh, A. Oh, I've just learned it's A. And within a second, you forget that you created it to be A. And now you think it comes from the A. You forget that you made it. You forget that you bought into it. You forget that you agreed it was A. Now you think it's A from its own side. But one Lama said, it's like we're all children who draw a lion and then become afraid of it. It's a very good example. So everything that does exist is what possesses the characteristic of emptiness of intrinsic existence. There's no such thing as emptiness on its own. Generality of emptiness, yes. Generality of red, yes. But when you have an experience of red or an experience of emptiness at a conventional level, or even not a conventional level, but even thinking about it, you're thinking about it, you've got to have a thing in front of you that possesses that characteristic. Okay, when you're meditating on emptiness, that's different, they say. All you have is what appears, if you've got subtle mind, you've practiced, and you've got the actual realization of emptiness. Nothing appears. You're just absorbed in the realization of the absence of intrinsic nature. Of course that sounds subtle to us, you know. We're talking about relative reality, the world we live in. Emptiness is not separate from everything else, in other words. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. So anything is the same. Cup is emptiness, emptiness is cup. Or cup is empty, cup is empty. Emptiness of, is that, so spell that out, and what it's saying is this. Cup. Dependent arising cup. This is spelling it out. Dependent arising cup is empty of inherent existence. And emptiness of the inherent existence of the cup is dependent arising cup. And dependent arising cup is empty, and emptiness of inherent cup is dependent arising cup. They both come to be the same thing, and that's the final middle way. Form is empty, emptiness is form. Form is nothing other than emptiness, emptiness is nothing other than form. So empty me, dependent arising I, is empty of inherent existence. And that emptiness of inherent existence of I because that's what's empty, the I. The emptiness of inherent existence of I is dependent arising I. And dependent arising I is emptiness of inherent I. They're just simply another two ways of saying the same thing. So that's the middle way. And they say, finally, a Buddha, only a Buddha, has these two simultaneously. Even the greatest yogi, the Arya Bodhisattva yogi, in meditation sees emptiness. In their eyes, see things bopping around, you know, sees relative reality. Only when you're a Buddha, finally, they merge. That's the final middle way. Dependent arising and emptiness, simultaneous. This is the way Tsongkhapa says, that you can never become nihilistic, you know. So before lunch, let's ask some questions, and if you have any questions, people. Mm-hmm. Nothing? Where are you? Who's talking? Oh, okay, go.
I would like to ask you, how can we work on the emptiness of physical pain when we have
yes, physical darling. Unbelievably difficult. Because our body is our most powerful object of attachment, we all know that. It is the most difficult because it feels like the very essence of me, isn't it? It's unbelievably hard, sweetheart. But we can see these days, it's amazing, among many alternative healers, doctors, nurses, healers, are finding many methods, helping people with their minds to see it differently. That's really the thing. So that's the only solution, you know. And this is, it's almost in the beginning, because the pain is so stupendous, it doesn't seem possible because we don't realize, this is what's very shocking, we don't realize that why the pain is so severe. This is very shocking. We don't realize that why the pain is so severe is mainly because of what's in our mind. Because attachment just can't bear even a second of not getting the nice things. This is how intense it is. This is just samsara, Buddha calls. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is the analysis, but it's very hard to hear it because we just assume, of course I'm living in hell because I'm in pain. And you can understand people killing themselves. I mean, I know friends of mine who are Buddhist who've had such pain they've killed themselves because it's just literally unbearable. I can't imagine being in pain all the time. So it just shows, you know, how it's possible. I remember, always quote this story. This is where extreme stories are very powerful for our mind because they show our possibility. I remember Kirti Sintam Rinpoche mentioning, just in passing, one certain level bodhisattva, whatever level of bodhisattva, I don't remember. But obviously he must have been an Arya bodhisattva, must have realized emptiness. He said, for that bodhisattva, the action of cutting off his hand and feeding it to a starving animal is as inconsequential as a leaf falling off a tree. So what that implies, obviously, is that person has realized the emptiness of the I, which means they've given up attachment, which means they've given up aversion, which means they've given up all the nuts and bolts of what is the source of our pain. There's still a physical body, but because their compassion also is so stupendous, that compassion and that the result and the joy of their own mind overrides any physical pain. That's really the powerful point to prove that it's the mind. But that's fine to hear that, but to get there is another discussion, isn't it? But it's powerful to know that. And that's why these wonderful doctors and nurses and other people these days finding methods, meditation, even training the mind to see it differently, to find, that's the key to success of it. Although I just can't imagine being in pain all the time. Can't imagine it, you know. It's very intense. But it's possible. It's the only way we can say it. It's possible. And I think also even ordinary examples. I remember watching on the television years ago, before I was a Buddhist, a documentary about the outrageous things that mothers do to save their babies, their children, like running into burning houses, picking up cars. Now, listen to that point. It's logical. They're an ordinary person. But because of the intensity of their connection with their child, that second, and they think of their child in the burning house, all they're thinking of is their child. They notice it's a burning house, but they just run into the burning house. Why? They know it's burning, but the thing that's totally huge in their mind is their child. That's the same with that bodhisattva. All there was in that bodhisattva's mind was the unbearable compassion for this suffering person. So that compassion overrode this self-centered experience of fear and panic, which is what pain brings. Not being horrible about us. But when we understand this, it gives us a chance to kind of chip away at it, you know. Do you understand? Not easy. I can't imagine. I mean, I get some pains. I used to get this weird arthritic pain. Would start in the morning very small, one joint, and by night I'm on the floor crying like a baby, you know, and I have to go to the hospital and get steroids and things. And I was like, I couldn't believe the pain. I just couldn't believe it. I was just so distressed. One night I was staying in a hotel after visiting a prison, actually, and it started. And I couldn't possibly sleep, so I had to drive all night. It was freezing cold with the window down, the air blasting me, and I was tired because the only way I could sort of bear the pain was focusing on something else. Do you understand? I'll never forget it. And then just, and I used to think, imagine if this never stopped. Because luckily it went after 36 hours. But I mean, this is how some people live. I can't even, I mean, that just filled me with horror. Because at least I knew it would end at some point. But when it never ends, I can't imagine that. There's things we can do. We have to be brave. Do you understand?
Question concerning organ donation.
What?
Organs donation.
Okay, good.
If I understood well.
What, sweetheart?
If I understood well.
Oh, yeah.
It's not good to die donating organs.
I didn't say that. I did not say that. I did not say that.
Okay, I didn't understand well.
Okay, go on.
Isn't it shocking to donate organs? For and go pass on another life for a person, isn't it shocking?
I don't understand what you mean by shocking, darling.
You trigger your not calm and you.
Oh no! Okay, okay. Okay. I said some things that you're only saying some of the things I said, which is why. Yeah. I have to speak slowly. I just never do, but I give up. I think when I die, I'll speak slowly. Okay, darling, it's like this. It's like this. In this tradition, how it's presented from the Vajrayana point of view, the analysis of the death process. At the time, it's a process of 8 stages of this gradual deconstruction of all the bits and pieces that make up a person, you know? So the first 4 stages is when our senses gradually go and the 4 elements gradually cease. So they also, in the Buddha's teachings about the 12 links of dependent arising, Lama Zopa, in this book of his, which I edited, which I've been quoting from, describes the 12 in the 12 links of dependent arising, this particular process that occurs. He says there's a particular way that plays out at the time of death. So one is this 8 stages from the Vajrayana, and one is this 12 links in the Sutra teachings. So they're both these processes that are occurring, and they're obviously occurring side by side. So as you go through the 8 stages, by the time you say the first level is your earth element ceases, your eye consciousness ceases, then gradually your ears consciousness ceases, the different elements cease, and by about the second or the third stage, your eyes and ears have begun to cease. By about that point, in the 12 links, this very powerful craving and grasping kick in very strongly. And so as we know, attachment, craving and grasping, there's 2 extra levels of attachment, has many functions. One function of attachment, of course, is to grasp at what we've got, to hold on. So the main fear at death, they all say, is because we've got this intense attachment to me and the body and terrified of leaving it. And especially if you've never thought about death, never thought about impermanence, and especially if you just now finally this horrible thing is happening and you're just not ready for it. So it's very terrifying because of attachment. So this extra attachment kicks in at this point, and then the grasping kicks in, which is even stronger. And about that point, which is before you stop breathing, which is the 4th stage, this is the 2nd, the 3rd, and the 4th, the way Lama Zopa puts it, that's the trigger, that grasping is the trigger for the number 2 link, which is karma, the karmic seed to be triggered, because we've got thousands of karmic seeds in our mind. That grasping is kind of the energy that triggers the karmic seed that will determine our next life. It's very technical the way they describe it. So because grasping is intense and it's fear, then you really need someone helping you navigate death. It's really marvelous. That's why so many, I know the... Like in San Francisco, that group, they do really, I mean, so many of our places as well do helping people at the time of death. As Lama Zopa says, you know, if you're going to help anybody, they need you most then to help them navigate this, which means Even that grasping will still happen, but at least if the person, let's say they're a Buddhist practitioner, they're hearing their mantras, they're hearing their prayers, their friends are around them, they will feel secure, they will feel calm. And the mouse, the dog, the same, they will feel calm. And if you're calm, you can be virtuous. You can have good thoughts and have compassion. But if you're freaking out, all you can think of is I and panic and ego. It's just completely distressing. And then grasping happens then, that can only trigger a negative seed. So that's generally what happens. Now, the one of organs, Lama Zopa praises it. He says, it's incredible to give your organs. So compassionate. So if that's your motivation to give others, and then you die with this compassion on your mind, that's marvellous. That will trigger a virtuous karmic seed. It's fantastic. But I said the story when I read that book by an American journalist, you know, a medical journalist, and all the different stories of the obstacles and problems in the States in the medical profession about what even death is now. They're very confused, which is, I think it's good because they're questioning their assumptions. So there are these, and he was very quite cynical about it because he said some of the system is kind of arrogant and elitist and it's very manipulating and you're forcing people to give their organs. He was very critical of the whole thing in many ways. But the real point here for the Buddhist approach, I gave that one example. He said, because what's happening, they keep you breathing when you stop breathing. Now, from Buddha, for this Vajrayana view, you're not dead. You could be 3 days before the mind, the subtle consciousness goes. So that's why it's so important to keep the place peaceful and not be interfering and let the body stay there for a couple of days and do prayers and practices to help the consciousness. And when it does leave, triggered by the karma that was triggered before they even stopped breathing, then it'll take a decent rebirth. So what happened? This woman, because she's kept breathing, her heart is beating. The materialist view says she's dead. But as Lama Zopa said, if you're breathing and your heart is beating and your body is warm, you are not dead, honey. The subtle consciousness is there. You're not dead yet. And that's why all the stories, even now he was quoting it, people coming back to life. There are stories like that all over the world, but no one knows what to think about that. The karmic, the Buddhist one, is because they haven't died yet. You stop breathing, your mind is still there, and then karma continues and you wake up again. Not uncommon. So this doctor quoted all these examples, so it's confusing to the doctors, you know. So anyway, this woman in the operating theatre, being kept breathing, heart beating, although they think she's dead. So the nurse monitoring the heartbeat could see as soon as they got the circular saw to cut her open, the heart went from 100 to 200 beats a minute. So the author joked and said, I wonder what a dead person has to be worried about. So he didn't have an answer because that doesn't fit with the materialist view. But this Buddhist view was very clear. That means, you know, there's another discussion now, but we discussed this. He had a whole chapter on people who have so-called out-of-body experiences. Do you understand? People in their operating table watching what's happening. And usually the doctors are so cynical about this. They say, don't be ridiculous. It's not possible. But he quoted one story of one woman who had to have such a radical procedure that they practically had to make her dead almost before she had the operation. No sign of any, all her vital org, everything had to be stopped to do this very difficult operation. So from their point of view, it would not be possible to be conscious. But she reported the most vivid so-called out-of-body experience. So the doctors just don't know what to say about this. So you can't argue that it was true what she said because she observed everything they were doing. She heard she heard all the jokes they cracked, the music they played. They can't possibly argue with this. And I remember even one doctor quoted in the book saying, I can now say with certainty that consciousness is not a function of the brain. I don't know what it is, but that much I can say. So I think this is great in general, they're discussing. But the point is this. This whole chapter he had of these people with these experiences. So this is what we call the subtle consciousness. Remember, we've got gross consciousness. This is the Vajrayana. Then we've got subtle consciousness, which is our dream mind, or when you're dead, it's when you stop breathing and you're still in the body. And then there's very subtle consciousness. So subtle mind, like we've been talking, that's when we can have dreams. People can have clairvoyant experiences. People can, this common experience, these women, these people in the operating table, they are unconscious at the gross level, but they're vividly watching what's happening. That's their subtle consciousness. They haven't left the body really. It just it's experienced like that. That's subtle consciousness that doesn't depend upon the brain. Do you see my point? Now, so I can only deduce that the fact that her heart beat 100 beats faster, because her mind is still in the body, she still knows she's her, and suddenly they're cutting her body and she's having a panic attack. Well, you would, wouldn't you? You know, she must be thinking they don't realize I'm dead yet. Of course you'd freak out. That can change the karma. That's the point. So not everybody has that experience, but you can't guarantee they won't. So it could, in other words, it's a tricky thing. And as Lama Zopa said, the yogis, the meditators have got to talk about this. It's not that easy. It's not that simple. Are we clearer now? Okay. And frankly, my own opinion, there's so many ways to help people with your body. You know, give it to the young doctor so they can cut it up and use it to learn anatomy. But we're so obsessed with all this. I mean, he was critical. This doctor, he's in the profession. But when it's ego-based, very elitist, very manipulative, forcing people to give their kids organs and things, that's very shocking, you know. And I think there's many ways to help human beings. Not just give organs. It's an amazing skill, but it's made so holy and unique and special, you know. It's very interesting. I'm not trying to be rude about it, but do you understand my point? So, I mean, we have to think about that, decide what we want to do, you know, ourselves. Are you clear now? It's lunchtime. All right, let's think of our lunch as empty. Coming from the mind. Nothing from the side of lunch whatsoever. And that's proved if you had, you know, like if you were very sick now and had a fever, you would look at the lunch and you'd see it as disgusting. So where's delicious lunch? I'm sorry. Come from your mind, okay? But nevertheless, it still nourishes you. That's the tricky bit. So we think of delicious lunch, big as the universe, and we think of offering it to all the Buddhas, all the Bodhisattvas, all the suffering sentient beings, and may they experience the joy of receiving it. We would if we could do that. How amazing. Lama Sange Lama Chö Dejen Lama Gedun Te Kongi Jepo Lama Te Lama Namla Chö Pa Bo. And then think, like a Bodhisattva, I'm going to eat this food so I can be fat and healthy, so I can continue working on my mind, continue to benefit sentient beings. Okay. So what's the plan? Same as every day? Same thing? So for those who... We've had all week, we've had this discussion groups at 3 to 4. 2 to 3. 2:30 to 3:30. You're not forced to do it. No one's going to police you. But it's really nice if you get with your friends, a couple of you, three of you, and you just nut this stuff out, unpack it, unravel it, and discuss it. You know, kind of like that. If you'd like to do that, that'd be great. And then bring some questions when we come back at 4:30. Yeah? Okay. Thank you, everybody.